Hello and welcome. It's Graham Norton here. Thank you for listening to my Virgin Radio podcast with Waitrose. Coming up, Emerald Fennell and Carrie Hope Fletcher join me in the studio to talk about getting back into the theatre for Andrew Lloyd Webber's production of Cinderella. Victoria Hislop joins us to chat about her new book, Maria's Island. And there's love in the studio with Matt Cain and his new novel, The Secret Life of Albert Entwistle. But before all that, here's Maria.
Yee-hee!
Good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
Happy sunny June.
Yes, you look very summery.
Well, I've been quite a lot of swimming and on the beach this week. So, you know, a little bit of sun damage.
Health and efficiency.
Health and efficiency. And yes, I put quite a bright dress on today.
People were
putting their sunglasses on the train.
Is there a nudie nude bit down in St. Leonard's and Hastings?
A nude beach.
A nude beach.
Of course there is.
Is there?
Yeah, but you have to scramble over some rocks and things like that to get there.
And then,
well worth it once you get there, though.
And then poke out your eyes with a stick.
No, what I mean is that, you know, it's not for the faint-hearted. You have
No, they never are.
You have to really want to get there.
It is funny when you're abroad in the Europe and then you stumble up. Well, like, you don't even need to stumble up because they're all a bit nuddy nude when you go to Europe.
Yeah.
What
do you feel about that? I'm not sure.
Oh. I mean, it's a good idea because everyone looks equally awful.
But I prefer a little bit of mystery. You know, I think sometimes...
There's a lot of mystery.
You need to retain some mystery in life, surely. And also when you're putting up, you know, bending over and putting things up like deck chairs and windbreaks and everything. It's all a bit flappy, frankly.
Oh, dear. Look away. Look away.
I had to laugh on the train this morning. There was a little girl who they were going up to London Zoo. And she was very, you know, bright and astute. Wasn't allowed to wear her watch. Why? Because you might lose it. But you wear your watch, Daddy. Yes. But how come you won't lose it? That sort of thing.
Yeah.
And she said the baby started crying. The head baby sister. Why have we got a stupid baby? At one point. And the mum said, because you wanted one. And I thought, now, this is not good advice to ask a small child if they want a baby or not, because a baby is for life.
No, but that is quite a funny thing to put on a small child so that, like, psychologically, she's damaged forever. Hurrah!
Yes. And then she started singing to the baby, Clara, you're my best friend. And when I got up to go, I said, you're going with your best friend now? And she looked at me and said, how do you know? How do you know she's my best friend? Because your singing was 95 decibels.
Yes, and I would watch that baby at the zoo, because I'd say Clara could end up in a lion enclosure at any minute and just chucked over a fence. Bored now.
I don't think I've ever been to a zoo. Have you?
Yes.
Why?
Because, well...
Have you got one in Ireland?
Yes.
Where is it?
We've got Dublin Zoo.
Dublin Zoo now.
And then there's a safari park on Fota Island outside Cork.
Oh, good.
They have a giraffe.
Oh, just the one?
Yes, just the one. With an I Heart Cork hat on.
You know your Irish zoos, Graham.
No, that could
be
wrong.
I thought I'd catch you out this morning, but no.
No. Well, I used to go to the zoo when I was at drama school, you see.
Why?
Because we'd have to do animal study.
Learn how to be, look
yes,
like...
Yes, so I, because I'm not stupid, people were like choosing all these animals that were outside. It was freezing. It was January.
What did you choose to be, a sloth?
Yes, because they were in a nice indoor heated enclosure, and I would just sit on a bench and nod off.
It's the story of your life, really, isn't it?
Yeah. And then...
That should be what your autobiography is called. Sitting on a bench and nodding off by Graham Norton. No.
And my sloth was still very good.
So you observed it when you were in your waking moments.
Well, I observed a bit. I mean, it doesn't do much.
And then did you have to give a sloth when you went back to drama school?
Yes, you did. Well, you know, at the end of the term.
You pay money to see that.
No, at the end of the term you did it. And what's weird is, everyone who did an animal, when I meet them now, I can still see them as the animal.
Get out.
And my hands are quite slothy. I do that. My hands
yeah,
are quite
he's,
slothy.
Yeah, listeners, he is kind of, you know...
I'm doing a sloth hand.
A sloth hand,
stupid.
Yeah. No, I know, but they might not know what a sloth hand is. Do you think there's video evidence of you giving your sloth?
No,
how long did your sloth performance last?
There's probably a cave drawing
sloth
of me
or
doing
sloth,
a
I don't know.
Sloth, I don't know.
Let's call the whole thing moth.
I kept it non-verbal throughout.
Non-verbal and short. Brevity is best, I think, where sloths are concerned.
Well, there's not a lot to do. I mean, as a story arc, it's quite slow. Basically, if you move an arm, that's really it.
Yeah. And an occasional eye roll.
Do you know what I need to tell people?
I
watched a kind of terrible but sort of great film last night.
Oh, yeah, what's it called?
Well, I think it's called The Invisible Guest.
Right.
And it's a Spanish film. Bear with me.
Is it in subtitles?
It's subtitles. No, but it's so easy. And it's on Netflix, I think. And it's a new film, but it's a proper old-fashioned potboiler. This guy comes to in his hotel room and his lover is murdered. And all the windows are locked from the inside and the chain is on the door.
Who did it?
And he's obviously been accused of the murder.
Yeah, but who did it?
And he's trying to find.
Who did it?
Well, it's really good.
I didn't want to have to watch it.
There is a twist in it that you can see coming a mile away. But what's good about it, when you see the twist?
Was it a block of ice that?
No. They do mention that though.
Yeah, good.
But there's a twist which even when you see it coming, you still kind of think back and oh, but I didn't see that coming immediately. So you know, I enjoyed about 10 minutes of this film, and I enjoyed it.
That's long, and the rest of the time nodded off on a bench.
No, stayed awake throughout. Thank you very much.
I'm going to suggest then Bo Burnham's Inside.
Oh yes, I nearly watched that.
Well, I think you'll hate it, but I quite enjoyed it because it's sort of mad and it's lockdown, and his hair grows and his beard grows and he's in one room. It's quite claustrophobic, but I stuck with it.
It was when I saw the little intro saying filmed during over a year during lockdown. I thought, nothing's worth that.
I know, but it's kind of, there's something genius about it, but I don't think it's for you because you have no patience.
No. I mean, making a show over a year.
Well, what else was he going to do?
I don't know.
And at one point, he was frightened of finishing it because he said, you know, if I finish it, then I'll have nothing to do.
Can you hear my eyes rolling?
Yeah. Do you want to stop me talking now?
I really do.
Okay. I can stop of my own volition. Look, stopped.
There you go. Virgin Radio.
I'm going to read you a first letter whether you want me to or not.
Okay.
Here we go. Dear Graham and Maria, for all of my adult life, I've been a loner and spinster. You don't hear that word often, do you? But 18 months ago, I decided to give internet dating another try and met someone who is perfect for me. I now have my first proper boyfriend at the grand old age of 45. We're getting on great, but I'm struggling to deal with my partner's relationship with his ex-wife. They split amicably 2 years before he met me. We're together for 21 years and have 2 kids, aged 18 and 20. He wants to stay friends with his ex for the sake of the kids, as his parents are divorced and don't speak, which is a situation he doesn't want for his own children. I feel like I'm playing second fiddle to the ex. I was particularly upset when I didn't get to see him on his birthday, as he invited her over for dinner with the kids. He reassured me that they're better as friends and will never get back together. I believe him, and I want us to work out long term. She's the mother of his children and will always have a place in his life that I can't compete with, but I don't want to be second best. How do other people manage relationships the second time around? And that is from Heather in Poole. Well, Heather in Poole, congratulations. You know, no longer a loner and a spinster. Woohoo to Heather in Poole in a relationship, and well done to internet dating. But I would say there's an awful lot for you to get used to here and to navigate, because you haven't done this before. You've said yourself you found someone who is perfect for you, but you had kind of, decided that you were on the scrap heap and that was that. You will never not be second to his children, I'm afraid. And that is a battle you won't win. But look, they're 18 and 20. If they were sort of 7 and 9, that would be a different thing, because there's a whole lot of growing up to do and guidance and so on. They're kind of off and running, up and running and going. And he wanted to spend the time with his family. You know, birthday schmirthday. I'm sure you saw him the next day and gave him a lovely present. Don't try and get between him and his children, because it's a battle you won't win. And you're right. You say, you know, he's going to have a relationship with this woman who he was with for 21 years. That's a long time. you don't want to be second best. Well, you're not to her, but you are to the children. So how do people manage relationship second time around? I think they have lots of patience. I can see Graham has dying to say something.
No, I just think, well, how do you cope? You've got to roll with the punches, because the trouble is...
Oh, it's a biffy relationship now.
Yeah. Well, no, but I just feel with Heather, I feel for her because this is her first proper relationship. So she wants...
Perfection.
Well, not perfection, but she just wants, you know, I love him. I want him to love me in that same way. I want it to be everything. And I want the candlelight. I want the romantic things. On your birthday, I want to spoil you. Oh, you're having dinner with your ex-wife and children. Great. You know, that is a smack in the face if you're in that kind of romantic wonderland way. He's been married for 20-odd years. He's got grown-up kids. So he's in a very different place. Now, two things I think will happen, Heather, is one, the kids are going to get older and they're going to have their own life. They're going to be travelling. They'll be away. Da, da, da. The other thing, and fingers crossed, let's light candles for Heather that this happens.
The wife gets another relationship.
Yes, ex-wife finds somebody else. And that takes so much heat off. So hopefully that'll happen. He married her, you know, and you like him. So maybe someone else will like her.
Yeah, I think the duty for you then, Heather and Paul, is to find somebody for the ex-wife. Mind you didn't find anyone for yourself and you've got to 45.
Yes.
But also, Heather... Yeah.
She's done very well.
You're 45 and he's probably a bit older. I mean, you know, we all have baggage with us, don't we? We all collect baggage on the way to our lives. And when you say, how do people manage second time relationships, they acknowledge that fact, that if you're getting into a partnership with somebody of 45, 50, whatever, they will have had lives before they met you, and you just have to let that go. I think maybe you could befriend the... Graham's saying no.
Terrible idea.
Take her a cake. You know that's my answer to everything.
Yeah, filled with poison.
No.
I think the thing is, Heather, you've got to match the reality to your expectations. Your expectations, because you've been by yourself all this time. In your head, you had a vision of what it would be like to have a boyfriend. Now at 45, you have a boyfriend, and it's not like that. And so,
well, it sounds pretty good, but
yes,
for the baggage.
But it's not what she expected it to be like. She really likes him, but it's not everything she wanted. And you've just got to make your peace with that, Heather, or try again. Get back on the old interweb and, you know, have one more go.
Yeah, but everything is working out perfectly. So don't let this become a deal breaker, Heather and Paul, because, you know, it's what... Just talk to your friends who are in second time round relationships and they'll give you some advice, because you can't have it all. Much as in life, something's got to give. And at the moment, you're in a very good position. The children are older. Thank your lucky stars for
that.
And we just need to get the ex... loved up as well.
Yeah, I imagine a lot of our listeners have been in this situation.
Do you think so?
Yes, well, you know, our demographic. And heads up, kids, my favourite responses today, we'll be getting a bottle of Waitrose Spanish Rosé. Anciano Garnacha Rosado Campo de Roja. It's Waitrose Spanish Rosé, isn't it? Delicious. I think I just coughed them up. So let's see who gets that. What does she do? How do other people manage relationships the second time around? Because this is all new for Heather. The whole idea of navigating any relationship. I mean, that's going to be hard. And this is this one has complications. Steve says, good morning, everyone. Just wait until the grandkids arrive. Oh, dear. Life is life. Smile and be happy. And that's the thing, Heather. You know, you can choose to be upset by this or just kind of enjoy the good bits. Enjoy what you do have and not kind of worry about the fact that it isn't quite the relationship you thought it was going to be. Next time something similar happens, arrange to do something fabulous, like tickets to his favourite band with your best pal. Show him you aren't going to mope around for him and we'll be having fun elsewhere. That's from Evie. Yeah, oh, leave him. That'll show him. Oh, wait, no. That's I've gone too far there, Evie, with your advice. Russell in Portsmouth. Maria is right. All right, I'll read on. No matter how long ago a marriage broke up, children will always come first. If Heather wants this relationship to last, she should respect all arrangements that her partner has with his kids. That's thank you very much, Russell. And another person says, why on earth did the ex have to come along to the birthday dinner? The kids are grown up. If he really wants to invite the ex, then why couldn't he also invite the girlfriend? Just rude and thoughtless. All right, fair enough. And Janet from Bedfordshire. Heather, I don't think you're being unreasonable wanting to be with him on his birthday. Next year, suggest you and the children do something with him for his birthday. He sounds like a great guy as he still puts his children first. You don't want one that doesn't. Isn't that the truth? But actually, the Waitrose Rosé, I'm going to give to Steve with his just life is life. Smile and be happy. You get the rosé. Graham's Guide. We've got another Graham's Guide. That was the whole point of me playing that jingle.
Oh, sorry. Okay, here we go. Dear Graham and Maria, I met my best friend at university and we've been close for over 10 years now. I think she's brilliant, funny, gorgeous and so genuinely kind. She's been my favourite person since I met her, and in the past few years it has crossed my mind a couple of times whether or not I actually think I have romantic feelings for her. Recently, I've come to the conclusion that I most definitely do. But on top of the issue that she may not feel the same and may not be interested in girls, although we've both chatted about being curious before, there's a bigger hurdle. She's in a relationship with a guy and has been for the last 6 months. Do I keep my feelings to myself and keep my best friend? Is it even fair right now? Don't know what that means. Please help. And that is from Genevieve in Aberdeen. What does it mean? Is it even fair right now?
I don't know. I just love there's someone called Genevieve in Aberdeen.
That's very good. Genevieve in Aberdeen. It's great to have a best friend and you've known each other for 10 years and that's brilliant. The very fact that you've discussed this and how you are both curious, etc., about, you know, other relationships, is good. But that would have been the point when you had that discussion about, you know, both being curious. That would have been the point. I would say there is no spark as far as she's concerned. Otherwise, something would have happened thus far. There's another clue here, which is she's in a relationship with a guy and has been for 6 months. So that's probably going well. I'm not saying you can't, you know, chop and change, but that seems to be going well. And I would say to you, 10 years is a long time for a relationship to, you know, evolve. And if it hasn't evolved in that way, it ain't gonna happen after 10 years, I don't think. And so I would just say keep your best friend because you don't want to muddle things up. And you would know. She's your best friend. You would know if there was some chemistry, if there was something there that you thought was worth working on. I swear to God, after 10 years, you would know that factor. The very fact that there isn't and you don't means leave it.
Also, the fact that Genevieve didn't know. Like, recently, I've come to the conclusion I do. 10 years! It took you 10 years to figure out you fancied someone. I mean, it's hardly a grand passion, is it? I mean, talk about a spark or a flame. I think there's nothing here.
I think what's happened here is that because your friend is in a relationship and you're a little bit jealous because perhaps you're not seeing her quite as much and you're going through a bit of a lonely patch. So you're scouting around going, but it was right there in front of my face, my best friend. Why has that not happened? And it hasn't happened for a reason. So, you know, look elsewhere, Genevieve in Aberdeen. Be happy for your friend as she's happy. Be there to pick up the pieces if it falls apart. And just carry on being a friend. Your time will come.
Yes, I would say don't sacrifice your friendship for a bit of an experiment. You know, I wonder what this is like. Oh, now look, I didn't like that. And I didn't like my. Now I don't like my friend anymore. So,
or she doesn't like me.
You. So I would say, Maria's right. If you want to explore this side of your personality, of your sexuality, then do it with someone else. Do it with a stranger. Don't do it with your best friend because
who really matters to you?
Yes, because if you haven't figured this out for 10 years, I'm not sure.
I mean, you know, there's slow burns and slow burns, but really, this just seems
like there's something that's not on fire.
This just seems like it's a thought that occurred to you because you're a bit bored and a bit lonely, and she's loved up with somebody else for 6 months.
Yes, I mean, I do think your friendship. I think your friend will be hurt if you use her for a bit of kind of curiosity. I just think it's rude. You know, satisfy your curiosity with somebody else and then see if your feelings develop for this friend. I really don't think they will. I think you're just, as Maria says, you're just a bit lonely and a bit bored and you've gone, oh, I like her. I could do that. That seems easy. So don't. That's rude. I think that's just rude.
And dangerous as well, because you don't want to lose her and it could all go very, very badly wrong.
Yeah. And you're called Genevieve and you live in Aberdeen. By the way, the best advice gets the Waitrose Spanish Rosé. We'll leave it at that. It's the Waitrose Spanish Rosé. It looks delicious. Tony says, Genevieve, don't do it and ruin a fabulous friendship. Focus your attention on someone else. That's what we were saying, really. If you're going to experiment, you know, if you're curious, don't try it on your best friend. Try it somewhere else first. Steve, how can this person continue a friendship whilst feeling like she feels? It's decision time, but who knows how she will feel in 6 months if she just distances herself? Well, actually, isn't this an ideal opportunity? Because the friend has this boyfriend now, so you will be seeing less of them. So now would be a good time to go and explore other avenues and do things. And then when you know, let's say she breaks up with a boyfriend, because people invariably do, then you could see how you feel then. An anonymous texter. Maybe you could talk to her about your feelings without making it obvious that it's her. Oh, what? A friend of mine. That conversation. I have a friend. Let's call her Genevieve. Oh, no, that's my name. Oh, no. I think if they are close friends, she might see through that ruse. Russell's in Portsmouth. Genevieve, don't do it. This is a recipe for disaster. If you made the move, it could spell the end of your friendship. Or certainly a big shift in your friendship. You know, it will take a while to get back on track. If your friend has zero interest romantically in you, I forgot that bit. Genevieve and the friend have even had a conversation about if they were interested in dabbling on the other side, all of that. So, it's very odd. And Helen just says, not sure this is worth it, Genevieve. Let it go. I am going to give... I'm going to give it to Steve. The Waitrose Spanish Rosé goes to Steve with his see how you feel in 6 months advice. I think that's wise.
The Graham Norton Radio Show with Waitrose. You can taste when it's Waitrose.
Virgin Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, smell that. I mean, that's food. I'm not being rude. What's that smell? It's the new show chef. No, it's food. But the show chef joins us now, Martha Collison.
Hello.
Is that correct, Collison?
Correct.
Apparently down in reception, they got it wrong.
Oh, they did. Collision is what we had. I didn't think it boded well for my first day.
One of the Collision family. Martha Collison. So you join us and you're going to be here every weekend cooking us delightful things. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Mmm, delicious. So, and what's the idea? Will you be focusing on different ingredients every week? Will you be focusing on different sorts of food? How does it work?
Bit of a mixture. So lots of lovely seasonal food, obviously, in this wonderful country. Our food goes on this amazing cycle and we get all sorts of different produce. So things like that, fun new recipes, kind of showcasing great Waitrose products, all sorts.
Ooh, lovely. And what are you focusing on today?
So today, the brief was my favourite Waitrose recipe. So of all the hundreds on the website, which is my favourite? So I've gone for something which is a proper kind of naughty, sticky chicken wings, because who doesn't love those?
I know. I mean, I'm pretending to talk to you, but really I'm being very distracted by a plate of delicious. So what is in them? How have you done them?
So it's a recipe by Sue Scott, and they are kind of Korean style baked chicken wings. So they're called sweet soy and burnt lime chicken wings. So kind of fancy, but really easy to achieve. We've got a lovely kind of sticky soy glaze on there with burnt limes.
And you did actually burn some limes, because we should explain to the listeners, Martha isn't here on like a little gas cooking stove out the back. There is here at the top of the tower a big, huge kitchen. So valuable, even my pass, which gets me into the posh toilets, doesn't get me in there. And so you've been in there kind of...
I have, yeah. It's a great kitchen. It's probably bigger than my whole flat.
It is very, very big, I have to say. I hope you weren't too lonely in there, because I felt for you in there.
Oh, thanks. No, I was all fine. Just getting on with the recipe. It's really great because you bake the chicken wings. They taste like they've been fried, but they've actually been baked, which
is good. So they look like they've been fried as well.
No, yeah. Just baked. You toss them. These are kind of really kind of fat, organic chicken wings. I love cooking chicken wings because they're always quite cheap to buy. I think everyone's interested in the breast, maybe the thighs, but not many people are interested in cooking the wings. They're a really economical cut to purchase.
I'm covered in chicken fat and just gorgeous. So Martha, remind us again what I'm eating. There's chicken wings with a Korean...
Yes, so these are sweet soy and burnt lime chicken wings, glazed. They've got this lovely kind of tangy, sweet and sour flavour.
Yeah, and there's kind of a saltiness there.
Yeah.
Oh, so good. And by the way, if you're thinking, very nice, then, you know, I'd like to make them, how? If you go to the Virgin Radio Instagram account, which is at Virgin Radio UK, then you'll find a link to the recipe there. And you can make them this afternoon. Cheap and cheerful. Really, really good. And are these just a starter, or are they just... I mean, right now I'm just a greedy pig eating them, but would they be a starter, or would you do them as a lunch with a bit of salad, or what would you do?
I mean, they could be both. I think they're a great starter. I do them often when we have friends come round, because they're just nice. Nice to get your hands into the food. It's nice to kind of serve up family style and enjoy it. But they also make a great lunch. They do kind of... They're really nice with just a really light kind of cauliflower salad or something like that on the side, just so you get more of a balanced meal, but really simple to make.
Yeah, and you're going to be here every week. So, can you give us a sneak peek of what we'll be getting tomorrow?
Oh, a sneak peek of tomorrow. It is going to be some steak sandwiches, and I'll tell you what else is going in the sandwiches tomorrow.
I want it to be tomorrow. That's what I want. That sounds fantastic. So you're going to make steak sandwiches, and do you have to get in really early to kind of prep up the kitchen and do all that stuff?
Reasonably so. Not crazy early.
But do you, and as a chef, I mean, because we'll talk to you some more tomorrow, because I know we've got some more time tomorrow. I'll talk to you about kind of your life and stuff. But I know that you were on MasterChef a few years ago.
I was on Bake Off a few years ago.
Bake Off.
Yeah.
Bake
Off. No, don't worry.
I don't know anything. But you were on Bake Off a few years ago. And so is that kind of when all this started for you, and you became kind of, you know, a person who could write about food and do all that stuff?
Yeah, definitely. I was on Bake Off and I was 17, so it was quite young. So I knew from that I wanted to work in food even before that moment. But that was a real time of confirmation that this world is somewhere I want to be firmly embedded, and feel really privileged to have been able to do that for the last 7 years.
Wow, fantastic. Well, we're so glad that you've stumbled out of the lift into our lives with baskets of food. Thank you so much for our chicken wings today.
You're very welcome.
And I cannot wait for my steak sandwich tomorrow.
The Graham Norton Radio Show with Waitrose. You can taste when it's Waitrose.
Virgin Radio.
I'm joined in the studio by Emerald Fennell.
Hello.
That's that voice. And Carrie Hope Fletcher.
Hello.
Oh, look at that. I'm so on it. I've identified the voices. Everyone knows what's going on. And huge congratulations to both of you. The first big, shiny, new musical opening in the West End is yours. So, Cinderella, you, Carrie Hope Fletcher, are Cinderella. You were just saying you knew you've been doing this for how long now?
2 years last month, I got the part. I got the call to say you will be playing Cinderella.
Wow.
And I've yet to get on stage.
But you've done some rehearsal, haven't you?
Yes, yeah, we're 5 weeks in to rehearsals now. So we are fully on our way to having a full production. It's
wow.
Very exciting.
And Emerald, was this your idea?
Well, I definitely can't take full credit for the concept of Cinderella, sadly.
Yeah.
I wish. But yes, I mean, Andrew Lloyd Webber, who's written the music and is obviously a famous genius, has always wanted to make a Cinderella. And we were talking a few years ago about how to kind of, you know, how to do that, because it's such a well-worn story. And for me, the trouble with it is that it hinges on, you know, a girl changing herself to be loved. And so the thing for me that was really important was saying, okay, well, how do we do Cinderella in all its deliciousness, with all its romance and joy, but kind of undercut that thing? So it's about, this version is about a Cinderella who is a sort of nightmare, sarcastic yeah. girl that everyone hates.
See why you called me.
We knew there was one woman for the role. And it's about kind of that decision. What do you do to, you know, if you want someone to love you, how far are you willing to change? And that's, I guess, the sort of crux of the show, really.
And this, because you've had this big, long gestation period, is it the sort of thing where, is it been too much time where you keep picking at it? You know, because at some point you've got to say, I've written a musical, it's finished. But of course, you haven't had to do that. You've been able to go back in and go, oh, actually, why? No.
Well, I mean, the jokes are getting ruder and ruder.
Good.
They really are.
And the sort of magic mic dance sequences are getting longer also. So I think, yes, yeah. In that respect, it's only getting better.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing.
There you go. Because for you, it must be so odd that these are new songs and yet you've been singing them for 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've had a 2-year rehearsal period. It's actually been quite amazing, unless sometimes the lyrics change and then you've got to unlearn lyrics, which is harder than just learning a new song. But it's been so amazing having like the whole team and seeing, like, because there's sometimes when you join a show and you never see the lyricist because they've, you know, they've written the songs and that's, you know, or it's, you know, a 30-year-old show and they're long gone and you never get to see them.
Yeah.
But having David Zippel in the room, he's like one of my, he wrote the soundtrack to my childhood. He wrote the songs to Hercules and like just the most amazing songs. And having him sat in the room listening to you sing the lyrics to the music that Andrew Lloyd Webber wrote, who is sat next to him.
Yeah.
It's just the most amazing rehearsal process I think I've ever had.
And is it kind of more collaborative because it's been taken, you know, because you've all been part of this thing for so long? Are you having more say than you normally would, Carrie?
It's absolutely terrifying when someone asks me anything. If someone turns to me and say, what do you think? I melt on the spot. So I would say, no, it hasn't been a collaborative process. It should have been, but I'm rubbish.
Yeah. That's not true. That's not at all true. It's been amazing. No, it's... We've had the time to all get to know each other, and so much about making something like this is about trust and intimacy, and also having the opportunity to fail and be terrible, you know, and suggest jokes that are awful or try something silly. And so we've been able to do that, and I think it's just made it much, I think it's really made it better. This, even though the last few years have been really difficult, I think creatively it's been wonderful for us. We've had so much time.
Yeah, but also, I guess what's happened to you in those 4 years, you know, in that you've had so much success. So presumably your confidence has grown. You're kind of going, you know what, that risky joke I wasn't sure about, now I'm very confident. Yeah, it is a good idea.
Yes, probably too confident because some of the jokes really are quite bad. Yes, I suppose so. It doesn't feel any different. The dynamic, I don't think it has changed very much, but certainly I feel more experienced, which means I'm less nervous, probably. But it's been a strange...
Yeah.
A strange few years.
Yeah. Well, listen, we'll talk about it more, but let's just remind everybody, Andrew Webber's Cinderella premieres, so we'll be previewing for this, but it premieres on the 14th of July at the Gillian Lynn Theatre here in London. Tickets available at andrewlloydwebberscinderella.com. You can imagine how to spell that. There's a lot of letters. andrewlloydwebberscinderella.com. There we go. And, you know, in all these kind of various, you know, lockdowns and all that stuff, how many false starts have you had?
Well, we were meant to open last October, but that was kind of scrapped quite quickly because of lockdown. But it's been the most amazing process. Like, there was one day where I opened my front door and had a portable recording studio turn up on my front doorstep that I then had to badly assemble myself in my bedroom, and then put headphones on, and I was suddenly hearing Andrew Lloyd Webber in his house, it's somewhere else, directing me on how to sing this song. And so there was so much remote recording. So much of the soundtrack was done sort of in isolation with no one actually seeing each other and not knowing whose voices you were listening to. But it's it's just bizarre.
And the song we just heard, is that the one you performed kind of on the stage of Her Majesty's?
Yes.
That video is beautiful.
It was heartbreaking. It was so sad just to see this gutted theatre. All the seats had gone. The whole Phantom of the Opera set wasn't there anymore. The stage was boarded over. It was one of those moments where I had to not make a fool of myself and sob whilst I was singing this really emotional song.
It's really emotional just to watch and hear that song in that space is just beautiful. And while Carrie was at home kind of putting things together, Emerald, you quite busy. TV, acting, you made a movie, you've won Oscars. I mean, you've had babies.
Yeah, I'm quite tired. It's been such a strange year because, as Carrie was saying, we're so... You're at home, you're with your family. In many ways, you're kind of living a teenage life because I was actually here for Cinderella rehearsals. Mm. We were in the theatre when the government shut down the theatres, so we had to all kind of immediately leave. And so then I was living in America at the time, working on the film, and then me and my husband and baby lived with my parents for 4 months in the countryside, and I immediately became 13. Like, just... furious. Where are the baby bells in the fridge? Just being an absolute monster.
Slamming doors. Lighting candles.
Exactly. And meanwhile, all of this stuff with Promising Young Woman, which was the film that I directed, was going on. And so we were kind of, me and Carey Mulligan were doing this Zoom awards season. It's all been a bit bonkers. Yeah. And then The Crown, of course. I mean...
Yes, because you're Camilla in The Crown.
Are you done now?
Are you doing more Camilla?
Done, because you do 2 series each.
Okay, who's the new Camilla?
Don't know yet.
Oh, have they not announced?
Don't know.
Okay.
I mean, if it's playing an older me, I'm presuming Claudia Schiffer.
Prairie Light, yes.
Angelina Jolie.
That kind of... yes. You can see the direction they're going
It just needs to be realistic that it would be me.
Listen, I've got to ask you, because who knows when I'll meet someone else who was at that weird Oscars. What was it like? You were really there. And it was in a train station. I know they had to think outside the box. That seemed a very odd place to go.
Well, it was interesting because it didn't feel like a train station because they made it sort of felt like a speakeasy. So you were only allowed to go if you were a nominee. It was a nominee and guest. So there were just 300 of us. And actually, weirdly, it was really nice. Normally, it's about 3,000 people, which is so intimidating. And especially if it's Brad Pitt and all of those kinds of guys. I mean, what do you say to them?
They were there, though, those people.
Oh, well, actually, you're absolutely right, but they were quite far away from me, so I couldn't go and accost them as much as I wanted to. Look, it was amazing. It's a completely extraordinary thing to even be nominated for an Oscar, and so in any year, it's going to be mind-blowing. I actually felt quite lucky because I was the first person to win one on the night, and I didn't know what the format was because it was different, and so I just had a complete mind blank, and I just thought, I just didn't even remember what I'd said. It was so embarrassing. But no, it was incredible.
Yes. And also, I mean, they didn't play anyone off. You must have watched it, did you?
Yeah.
Because your friend was there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was like, because they weren't playing anyone off, so speeches could be as long as they wanted to be. And I think it was good because from moving forward, we now know why they play people off.
Well, I tried to... Because you were good. They had this terrifying thing where they said, we don't want a speech this year. We want a story. We want an anecdote. And you're like, I don't know how to do that. I can't do that. So it was quite intimidating. But, it was just amazing. It was amazing.
And the movie is so good, Emerald.
Thank you.
It is. And it's out on everything now, isn't it? It's streaming.
It's streaming on Sky.
You cannot avoid it.
And Now TV here.
Yeah, and it's just great. And Bo Burnham, we were talking about Bo Burnham earlier because his special is out now.
His special Inside just came out on Sunday and it's just exceptional. He's a genius. It's really annoying when somebody that you know is as nice and as kind and as good as that and then just comes out and is a secret genius too. Yeah. It's very undermining to the rest of us.
Well, listen, I'm thrilled for the two of you that this is finally blinking into the light. Cinderella is arriving on the stage at the Gillian Lynn Theatre from the 14th of July. Tickets start at £19.50 and available from Andrew Lloyd Webber's Cinderella.com. I mean, that's a handy website right there.
I'm just wondering if there's presumably no apostrophe in the Andrew Lloyd Webber's...
No, it's just... It's all one word.
We're not going to get in trouble with the grammar.
AndrewLloydWebber's Cinderella.com. Marketing genius. Thank you so much for coming in to see us. Good luck on the 14th of July.
Thank you.
We'll be cheering to the rafters.
The Graham Norton Radio Show with Waitrose. You can taste when it's Waitrose.
Virgin Radio.
Best-selling author Victoria Hislop. Her first book was a huge international hit called The Island, and she returns to the island now with a new book for younger readers called Maria's Island. So, Victoria, first, I always think, what sort of, because this is a book for people who can read themselves, I think.
Yes, although I think that some parents will read to their children.
Yeah.
I think the 8-year-olds, because actually children love being read to right up until they're, you know, 11 or 12, so either or.
Okay, so for lazy children, they can get it read to them. For the ambitious go-getters. No, because as I was reading it, I was thinking, no, you could imagine a child, kind of, this might be like their first proper big full book, then they'd feel really proud that they read it.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I haven't held back with either the ideas or with some of the vocabulary. I mean, I was quite surprised that my publisher let, you know, some of the words I use through. I thought they'd say, oh, no, that's much too adult. But actually, many children deal with quite adult themes in their reading, and it's good to kind of stretch with new words, new longer words.
And of course, some of the words are place names, which are always going to, you can't particularly simplify them.
Absolutely.
And it's so if people haven't read The Island, and there must be very few people in the world who haven't, but if they haven't, how does this book relate to it? Because these aren't the same characters, but it's the same setting, am I right?
Well, the setting is principally a little island called Spinalonga, which is just off the coast of Crete, which for 50 years was a place where people with leprosy were sent during the period when it was still an incurable disease. And they needed to be isolated, so almost worldwide, the law said that if you were diagnosed with it, you had to go into a leprosy place of isolation, essentially.
Yeah.
Because
we used to call them colonies, didn't we?
Yeah, colonies, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It was a colony. So in my book, The Island, which takes place over a couple of decades, we have a family where two generations are afflicted by this disease. And what I suddenly realised last year was that actually my principal characters were actually children, even in the adult book. And when a school teacher out in Crete said to me, I'd love to read The Island to my class, but it's a little bit adult, I realised that I could actually adapt it for children, because I think generally children like to read about children.
Yeah.
So I just took the main characters in the early kind of chapters from the original book and just led them all the way through. And it wasn't actually that difficult to do because, you know, as I say, children's emotions and reactions were very much at the core of the original.
And was it weird for you to revisit that particular story?
Well, at the time, not particularly, because we were living through these strange times.
Yeah.
When, you know, when I began writing it and while the illustrations were being done.
By Jill Smith, and they're gorgeous.
Amazing. They
yeah.
are really beautiful. You know, if we had TV cameras, we could show them off.
Yeah.
But of course, we were suddenly confronted by an incurable disease, and it had come out of nowhere, and we were, the word isolation became a kind of almost daily part of vocabulary, and lots of children were losing grandparents. So suddenly a book that I started writing 20 years ago suddenly seemed to have this new relevance.
Yeah.
So it seemed very natural time to put it together.
And I don't think, we never had leprosy in this country, did we? Or leprechaun?
Yes,
did we have leprechaun
certainly
here?
Absolutely.
Oh, did we? Oh, because
yes.
I was reading this thinking, oh, this must have been, it must have been around the Mediterranean. Because I remember in Irish schools, we were always getting bishops in to tell us about the missions.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, we eradicated it in this country, you know, a long time ago. But in the Mediterranean, and even particularly in Norway, strangely enough, no one quite understands why there, but there's a big... there was a big leprosarium there during the 19th century, And that's why the disease is often called Hansen's disease, because the bacteria was identified by a Norwegian doctor called Armauer Hansen. So, you know, it's still very, very current, and there are still maybe 300,000 new cases a year.
Now, that's the thing I couldn't believe, because, you know, in my head, leprosy is one of those diseases. It's gone. It's cured, eradicated. But at the back, Lepra is your charity. You're an ambassador for Lepra.
Indeed.
And so it's still, where is it still going?
Mostly in India and Bangladesh, and both in urban areas and in very rural areas as well. And the reason that it still exists and people often don't come forward for diagnosis is that it still has this stigma. You know, it's unlike any other disease. If you discovered that you had it and there's a cure, you immediately reach for the doctor and the drugs, and the doctor and the drugs are both there for leprosy. But because there's this almost biblical stigma, people used to think it was a curse from God, so they hide away and the disease develops. But what we're at Lepra, we send doctors out into these rural areas to educate and to diagnose. And as I say, they're still finding several hundred thousand new cases a year, which is an extraordinarily and kind of absurd situation.
It really is, because like I say, I just assumed it was one of those things just gone.
Yeah,
but
no,
there
most
it is.
People do. I think till I wrote The Island, I assumed that as well. So it was a bit of a discovery for me.
But you were talking about, you know, your relationship with Greece, and actually someone's, people have been texting in about that. Yasmin and London, what originally drew you to Greece? Do you have a family connection to Greece?
I have no family connection, but the first time I went, I was 17, and I hadn't really travelled anywhere else. You know, I grew up in the 60s, early 70s, when you didn't go abroad on your holidays unless you were very wealthy.
Yeah.
You went to Bognor Regis. Well, that's where we went anyway. And it was a week of, not hell exactly, but I really didn't enjoy being cold and being made to swim.
Well, Bognor Regis, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to offend any listeners from Bognor Regis, but my views about Bognor are fairly well known, I think.
But I guess a terrible holiday is quite good, because then you kind of look forward to going home, you don't mind your job so much.
Absolutely. But so, of course, when I went from Bognor Regis suddenly to Paros in the Cycladic Islands, it was life-changing. You know, I thought, this is where I'm meant to be. And from that age onwards, I started going every year, and the relationship sort of developed, and I wrote The Island, learnt the language, bought a house, and last year I was given citizenship by the president of Greece, which was just the most glorious thing that could possibly have happened in 2020.
Wow. So you got to go last year?
Yes, I did. Yes,
yeah.
I went to meet the Prime Minister and the President, and they handed me a passport, more or less, which was the most amazing gift.
I'll have that. Thank you very much.
I think I can even vote in Greece. So, yes, I have full citizens' rights.
Yeah, you kind of have to vote for them, though, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the deal.
Yeah, it would be very unfair to turn against them. You did a lovely thing, I think, because when The Island came out, it was this huge thing. Hollywood came and must have come a calling, because it's such a great story. And you said no to Hollywood.
I did, mostly because I feared that they would make the leprosy patients into sort of monsters in some way. And they might easily have done, because sometimes people with leprosy do look extremely strange. Anyone who's seen Ben-Hur will sort of remember the images. So I turned them down, because a particular Hollywood studio, when I asked if I could be involved and a consultant on it, they said, no, thank you, that's not our policy. So that for me was a red flag.
Yeah.
And then shortly afterwards, a Greek TV company approached and said I could be involved in every level of the production. And so I said yes. And that's what happened. We made a 26-part TV series out of it.
And presumably it's never been on the BBC or Sky or anything, but is it available on some streaming service somewhere?
There are some episodes on YouTube.
Okay.
But I've also recently resold the rights for an English-speaking production. So I'm hoping that we might make, you know, another TV series out of it.
Yeah. Old rope, hello.
And it will be, you know, hopefully people will enjoy it, because it's a strange story. you know, to have written. But it has this incredible sort of redemption because there is a cure and people leave this island of, you know, difficulty and misery and they resume their ordinary lives. So, you know, without that, I don't think people would even like the story. But if you kind of add in that there's a sort of love story and a very, very happy outcome to it, I think it would be lovely to remake it.
And in your head, all those years ago, when you're writing that first book, The Island, when did you twig, or when did your publishers twig, that this wasn't just a successful book, this was a huge international breakout hit?
It happened reasonably early on, once it was out, but it wasn't easy to find a publisher. It was rejected by quite a few, and some of them said,
"Must be so awful."
Oh, we love the Greek island, you know, setting, and we love the love story, but the leprosy is a bit of a problem. And one of them actually said, could you lose the leprosy? And I said, actually, I think I can lose you. Goodbye. And off I went into the night. But yes, there's something about it. I mean, it's sold, you know, in 40 countries now. And I think different readers, like with any book, you impose your own life experiences, your fears, your hopes into the story, and the characters mean, you know, different things for different people. So I can't really account for this sort of success of it, I must say.
And retelling it for children, or retelling a version of the story for children in Maria's Island, has that kind of whetted your appetite? Might you do more books for younger readers?
Funnily enough, I have had another idea.
Oh, wow.
Which I'm really excited to write. And again, it's an element from one of my children, one of my adult books, which is a story about a child. And I suddenly thought I would love to bring that story alive in a different way, but for children.
So. And the writing process, is it very different because you're thinking of a different audience?
I didn't feel it was particularly different because I never talk down to children. And I didn't feel I needed to write down for them. It was rather similar. I mean, children are actually far more intelligent than most of us adults. You know, they have a gloriously sharp, clear way of looking at life. And, you know, so I would never say, oh, I'm writing for children now. Let's use easy words and simplify things. I think I when I'm with children, as I was with my own kids, we never, you know, talk to them like they were less intelligent than we were.
And I should say to people thinking about getting this book, it's sad, but it's never grueling. Your children won't wake up in the middle of the night screaming.
No, I hope not. And I think the illustrations absolutely lift it to this wonderfully kind of emotional and beautiful level.
Well, thank you so much for coming in to see us. Victoria Hislop's Maria's Island is out now, illustrated by Jill Smith.
Thank you, Graham.
Lovely to see you. And now I'm joined by the brilliant Matt Cain to chat about his new book, The Secret Life of Albert Entwistle. He's also bringing us news of his sparkling new show on our brand new pop-up station, Virgin Radio Pride.
Hi, Graham. Thank you for having me.
I nearly forgot to say your name then. I felt like I'd said Albert Entwistle. That's enough, surely. But no, there's another name, Matt Cain. Hello, hello, hello. So congratulations on this book. What a lovely, lovely thing. How do you describe it to people? What do you tell people?
So I would say it's all set in the northwest of England in a fictional town in Lancashire. It's about a 60-something postman. He's shy, he's socially awkward, he's lonely, and we find out that he's secretly gay. And after a series of life crises, he realises he doesn't want to live like that anymore. He wants to turn his life around, he wants to be happy, and he knows that the only way to achieve this is to set off in search of the love of his life, a man he hasn't seen for nearly 50 years. And what happens is, over a series of flashbacks, you find out how they were cruelly torn apart and what happened. But this is contrasted with his journey to find him in the present, when he finds a community that now is welcoming him in. He makes these unexpected friendships with people he thought were very different, but realises they have a lot in common. And the point is, it's a kind of celebration of how far we've come since those days, because I'm sure you'll have something to say about this, but even when I was growing up in the 80s, it was a horrible time for gays. And I could not have imagined how much better things would get, way beyond all expectation. You know, how much we're accepted and welcomed now.
Try being Irish. but what I love about this book is that it is the rarest of things. It is a proper gay romance.
Yeah.
You know, normally, you know, there are gay love stories and they're tragic, or there's, you know, gay love stories and they're comedy, or they're, but an actual unapologetic romance. And when did you get the idea that that's what you wanted to write? That's what you wanted to create?
Well, funnily enough, I'd always wanted to do a story of somebody looking for a lost love and contrasting what it was like then with now. But yeah, I realised that love stories and romances for gay characters were very unusual. And I kept thinking about, you know, I want people who read it to feel proud of the role that they've played in making society better. And I think of my female friends, the ones who stood up for me in the school playground when I was being picked on, the first ones I came out to because I knew I could trust them because they were by my side. And when I started writing, publishers quite often said to me, women readers don't want to read gay stories. And I had to battle through a lot of rejection. And I kept thinking about my female friends who'd always been interested and engaged in my life and my love life. And I thought, I want to write a love story that everyone can empathise with and brings everybody together and makes everybody feel good and uplifted.
Yeah, because we ought to say the book is very kind of, if you say mainstream, it's kind of a weird thing to say, but it is. It's not an exclusive thing. It's not a niche book. It's a very...
Well, yeah. Funnily enough, Graham, when I first was pitching my first novels, publishers used to say to me, oh, if you're writing a mainstream book for women who shop at Asda, you can't write about gay stories. If it's literary fiction for intelligent women, they're open. They're open to gay stories. And I used to think, don't say that. Don't patronise these women. Don't patronise these amazing women in my life. I know that they're open to these stories because they're open to my story. And, you know... yeah, I think that's partly why I wanted to do something that would appeal to everyone. And funnily enough, the main theme of the book, the motto is, it's never too late to start your life's big adventure. And that's another thing that's really connecting with people in the mainstream because, you know, we've just had this massive reminder of how precarious life is and how everything can be taken away from you. And now is the time to go out and find love, to pursue your dream, to make amends for mistakes you've made, or yeah, you know, reconcile with a brother you fell out with. Now's the time, because we're not going to have the time again, are we?
And also, I think it's that thing where a lot of people, I think, look forward to retirement. They can't wait for, you know, that moment to come. But there are people who love their jobs,
yeah,
who are in industries where come 65, like it or not, you are packing your bag and going home.
Well, funnily enough, that's exactly what happens to Albert at the beginning. He had this traumatic experience in his youth, so he pulled up the drawbridge to the world. He wanted to cut off the possibility of being hurt again, but he didn't realise he was cutting off the possibility of being happy again, and he buries himself in his job, and he convinces himself, because he's a postman and he's saying hello to people on his round and posting birthday cards, yeah, and you know, he knows what's going on in their lives, convinces himself he's a member of the community, and then when he finds out he's going to lose his job because he's got to retire, yeah, that's what prompts the whole life crisis, prompts him wanting to turn things around.
We must also talk about your role here at Virgin Radio, because you are part of Virgin Radio Pride, which launches tomorrow. Chris Evans is, I don't know, he's firing a cannon or something, and it's starting tomorrow. So tell us your role in Virgin Radio Pride.
Well, first of all, the station as a whole, it's a pop-up that's going to last for 3 months. Obviously, a sister station to Virgin Radio
UK. We love
UK.
A sister station. We love a sister station.
And the idea is, it's not, I mean, it's quite similar to what I was saying about the book. Not confrontational, but celebratory. And the idea is to engage, entertain, enlighten.
It's not the BBC.
We've got some brilliant, brilliant presenters. The show that I'm doing is called Sunday Roast, and it's been described as a cross between Jeremy Vine and Loose Women for queer people, because okay, it's basically a discussion programme. So some of the topics we are going to be discussing are things like, after lockdown and COVID, not being able to go out, have we learned to reappreciate the gay bar and its importance in our community? Party. Or there's been a lot of talk about taking down statues of known racists and slave traders. Should they also take down the ones of people who persecuted gays? You know, the one that we're going to be discussing, I think, in the first show is everybody's talking about going on holiday at the moment. And as gay people, that's quite a tricky subject because there's still 69 countries in the world where they criminalise same-sex relationships. And some of them it's absolutely not safe to go to, Jamaica, Saudi Arabia, but there's some like Morocco or the Maldives where they say, the tourist boards say, it's fine, we only prosecute local people, you'll be safe as tourists. And I think, well, do we want to go there? Should we all boycott them? Is that the best way to bring about change? Or if we go with our boyfriends and we're visibly queer, is that the best way to provoke change? So it's those kind of discussions.
Who are you talking to?
Well, queer people predominantly, okay. LGBTQ+.
From reception to the 17th floor. Are you inviting them in? Or yeah, are they commentators and journalists and people like that? Yeah.
So we're going to have, yes. So we're going to get comments from listeners, absolutely, who can send in their contributions. But we'll also have a rotating panel on my show, experts in the field. And yes, journalists, personalities who are LGBTQ or... I nearly said all plus LGBT, yeah. Any of the letters, yeah. I'm getting mixed up myself.
But here's the thing though, Virgin Radio Pride, it's a pop-up station, you can get it on the app. Yes, you can get it on the app. This show is going to be simulcast. It's going to be simulcast on this station and Virgin Radio Pride. And I think Chris Evans' breakfast show with Sky is also on both. Your show's on Sunday just after this. But there is music. There's all sorts.
Yes. And funnily enough, it's kicking off tomorrow with the winner of a vote that's currently running to find the ultimate Pride anthem. So there's a choice of 70 on the Virgin website. I think the voting closes just after your show today.
It does. Basically, you've got an hour. You've got an hour. Yes. Enough to do it. Tell people how they do it.
They go onto the Virgin website,
yeah.
And there's 70 choices. You pick your top three. My top three, and A Little Respect by Erasure, I'm Coming Out by Diana Ross, and I think You Make Me Feel Mighty Real by Sylvester. I love that song.
Wow. Good choices. Very good choices. So this is all happening. It's from tomorrow. It kicks
from
off. Chris
tomorrow.
Evans kicks it off tomorrow with the announcement of the winner of the Pride Anthem, the ultimate Pride Anthem. Here on Virgin Pride Radio.
Virgin Radio Pride.
Virgin Radio Pride. VRP. Excellent. Very good. Thank you so much for coming to see us, Matt Cain. Good luck with your show and the best of luck with your book, The Secret Life of Albert Entwistle, out now in hardback. Lovely to talk to you,
Thank
sir.
Thank you for having
All
me.
All right. Have a great time on Sunday Roast. Thank you so much for joining me for the Graham Norton Radio Show podcast with Waitrose. I'm back on Virgin Radio from 9:30 on Saturday morning. And don't forget, the next episode of the podcast will be out first thing the following Monday. Chat to you then.
The Graham Norton Radio Show with Waitrose. You can taste when it's Waitrose. Virgin Radio.